You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Borders and Internet Governance, Challenges for Businesses Operating Abroad. Moderator was Tom Galvin of 463 Communications. Panelists included Jeff Campbell of Cisco, Steve Del Bianco, Association for Competitive Technology, Ambassador David Gross, U.S. State Department, Leslie Harris, Center for Democracy and Technology, Andrew McLaughlin of Google, and the Honorable Alan Michael, member of the U.K. Parliament.
Hello, my name is Tom Galvin. I'm a partner at 463 Communications, and I want to welcome everyone here to our panel on borders and the Internet. And we're going to take a look and have a good discussion about the impact as the Internet grows and as particularly high-tech companies work across borders, what are the challenges to navigating across those types of borders. So I want to introduce our distinguished panel. But before we do that, I want to take a moment to welcome our special guest, the Right Honorable Alan Michael. So why don't we give a round of applause? He comes from...
And to his
compatriots, would they please stand up so we can recognize them?
Don't be shy.
So appreciate you here today, and if we did not have them, then we would, in an international panel, span the globe from everywhere from as far away as Dallas, Texas. So fortunately, they can add a more international element to this, and also hopefully point out that as we talk about these things, that it's not just how U.S. companies interact overseas and navigate different laws and customs, but the impact that U.S. laws have overseas on companies all around the world. So what is our topic here today? Internet governance has really shifted over the last year as a debate about national issues that we saw in the WSIS process and other elements to really start to look at some of the issues that companies are facing as the Internet becomes more ubiquitous, as we see things like social networking take on new roles, which gives both opportunities and risks out there. It has to do with markets that companies are going into, and as they there's a collision course amongst companies as they run into different cultures, different laws, different customs. So we're going to spend some time talking about that. Let's start by asking each panelist to just quickly identify themselves and give their affiliation, and once we're done with that, we're going to actually go almost immediately to questions. So we'll go from there.
I'm David Gross. I'm with the U.S. State Department.
I'm Michael, Labour and Cooperative MP for Cardiff South and Penarth, and I think my job is to be the innocent amateur on this panel. I was Minister of State for Trade and Industry until last May, and in that capacity had the pleasure of being part of the discussions in Tunis, which leads me to an Internet Governance Forum is absolutely crucial for avoiding us being dragged into areas we just don't want to go. I've done a short paper which I put around, which I hope might help to persuade people, if you're not already persuaded, of the importance of that.
Andrew McLaughlin, Head of Public Policy for Google.
Leslie Harris.
And Steve Del Bianco with the Association for Competitive Technology. And I was persuaded to go to the, absolutely, to go to the Internet Governance Forum and all of the ICANN meetings to take a good look at American business interests.
Well, as you can see, we have a very large panel, which I intend to rule with a completely iron fist. So we'll keep it going. But we do have essentially another panelist, and that is you. So we want this to be an interactive session. After a couple questions to get the ball rolling, we're going to offer it out to the audience to pose questions, so please be prepared for those and be ready to challenge our panelists and ask them questions about how they're seeing, either perceiving where companies, particularly high-tech companies, are navigating in foreign markets, or how our foreign policy, our policy leaders here who are here, are seeing that as well. So let's kick it off by asking Ambassador Gross. This is going to be like the most open-ended question, but just to get us started, and then other panelists can kind of respond to it. But what do you see as the kind of pressing or emerging issues that companies are facing, particularly U.S. high-tech companies are facing, because that's largely what you're interacting with, that are facing that are different today as they kind of go into new markets?
Well, thank you very much, Tom, and I'm very impressed with the size of the audience that stayed this late. I know it's been a long day for many people, and it started last night for many of you, so I appreciate your being here for this panel as well. Let me sort of attack that very open-ended question with a couple of pieces of sort of international dialogue that we are having, because all of them directly affect U.S. business and lawmakers and the like. One has to do with the issue of internet freedom. Many have, as I do, being at the State Department, view this as an issue of free speech and one of which political issues are paramount. And at the State Department, as many of you know, we've been very active. A number of the people here, both in the audience and on the panel, participated in our Internet Freedom Task Force conference yesterday at the State Department that I thought was extraordinarily good in terms of how vigorous the discussion was, and both in terms of the audience as well as the panelists. But I also want to make sure that people realize that this is something that goes further than just this traditional free speech piece. It goes to the ability of companies to innovate, both in terms of access to information to innovate. It also goes to their ability to act in various markets, and much of the discussion yesterday was about the difficulties that U.S. and other companies have in doing business in certain countries who have different rules of law and seek to impose them, sometimes in ways that are thoughtful, sometimes in ways that are oppressive, and the difficulties that come from that. So one is the issue of the free flow of information, broadly construed, and how that impacts individuals, countries, companies, and the like. In addition, there was a discussion, as the Minister had said before, about things like the Internet Governance Forum. That was an outgrowth of the World Summit on the Information Society, which I think it's fair to say had a very positive resolution, although many of us worried and spent a lot of time and were very worried for until after the last moment about that. But it ultimately was very positive. I think it was positive from many perspectives, including those associated with U.S. companies and the like, the ability to do business, the ability to communicate. And one of the outgrowths that was hearing from the developing world their concern that they had no place to go to have serious policy discussions about these very important issues that affect them as it affects everyone in the world. There are places like OECD and many others for the developed world to come on a regular basis, even forums like this, but many fewer for the developing world. And so the Internet Governance Forum was created. They had its first meeting in Athens late last year. And although, there was lots of trepidation, I think it was actually a smashing success. It was a smashing success largely because it was well-attended. Very strong cross-section of the world was there, including from the developing world. It was a substantive set of conversations about multilingualism, about free flow of information, about technical issues, but yet done in a way that was not one that sought to impose a decision on anybody or any government. And we're hoping that that same style and process will be replicated in the meeting in Brazil in November of this year. Then similarly, in terms of trying to understand what's going on, I came from a meeting this morning across the river in Virginia, a joint NSF-OECD meeting in which they are looking at things such as the NSF Gini project, which is looking at the next generation networks and what it means in terms of the Internet, how it should be designed, what are the possibilities there. And so from a U.S. corporation and international corporation perspective, trying to have a better understanding about where the technology is going, and then from a lawmaker's perspective and from a policymaker's perspective, to try to facilitate, where appropriate, that future and that flexibility will be very, very important. So there will be a ministerial in 2008. The OECD will be hosting. It's only the second time the OECD has hosted a ministerial in this area, technical area. The last one was about 10 years ago. And that will clearly be a place for the 30 countries plus others will come together and we'll talk about the future of these issues and the opportunities for companies and countries alike.
Sort of a microphone issue there because I know that we couldn't hear you, so if I'll trade off there. I'd like to ask any members of the panel if they want to kind of react to that. If not, we're going to throw a piece of red meat at Alan here. But.
In that case, I better get him with something else quick. I think when one hears words like freedom, it's always in the instinct to say, and I think it's true, that with all freedoms come responsibilities. And it's better to have a culture of taking responsibility than to have a culture of waiting for enforcement. They're always very effective at doing things, whereas partnerships, working things through together, looking at how enterprise can be encouraged within an appropriate environment do. And I think the example I would give is the way that in the UK we've dealt with child abuse. I won't call it pornography, it's child abuse, because behind the images are actual abuses of children. And what we've ended up with is a partnership involving children's charities, non-governmental organisations, law enforcers, the police, government and industry, together succeeding in reducing the number of images of child abuse hosted in the UK from something like 16% down to less than 0.1% over a couple of years. And as a Home Office colleague said to me at the end of our review session, 10 years with legislation, I just commend the partnership model and not too much fear about each other as the right way forward. Trust is actually something that has to be earned, but it's worth working at.
Is there any other panelists who want to react to that? All righty. So, Alan, this issue of internet governance and the issues that U.S. companies face overseas, and they're obviously facing more and more, runs both ways, though. There's the issue of what U.S. laws and the impact they have overseas, particularly on other companies overseas. The online gambling ban that the United States imposed, I know that's caused a bit of a issue in the UK. What's your reaction to it, and why don't you tell us what kind of impact that's having in the UK?
Yes, I think it's not an issue that gets me terribly excited, to be perfectly honest.
Darn it.
But I think it's one of those issues that is seen for many people in the United States as, if you like, a moral issue and a constitutional issue. And it's seen, I think, not just in the UK but more widely in Europe, as a competition issue, as an issue. Is it possible to refuse access, in effect, to a market on geographical grounds, when in many other ways the United States impinges on all sorts of other markets, or United States companies do. I mean, perhaps it's more grown up to regard all these companies as not either American or European or British or Japanese companies, but as international companies operating in an international market. And I think there is, if you like, seen as something, it's almost as if freedom and flexibility has increased on our side of the Atlantic, and there's a more sort of old-fashioned Stalinist approach over in the United States.
If I can add to that, I think that when the United there's a couple of issues, and actually I was surprised David didn't raise just the question of these sort of conflicting regulatory with companies, but companies more generally. I mean, the gambling ban is the one that you know that we've launched out for the rest of the world to deal with, but for companies operating on the internet or operating across borders, sometimes that operates positively. I think the pressure from having laws on privacy in other places is moving companies in this country to the view that there's a race to the bottom, or a potential race to the bottom, that companies that are operating internationally and they can't do gambling in this country and they can't do something else somewhere else, that just for operational purposes it's easier to decide, you know, and this is, I think, more for online operators and service providers to sort of, you know, limit much more broadly across the board about, you know, what they're going to provide, et cetera, not because there aren't any borders, or you better than I, where people are trying to enforce their laws on content that doesn't reside in that country. So I think those are some of the most complicated, I think, issues that we're facing. And while the internet freedom issues, I think, are part of that, it's not just internet freedom issues.
Let's turn to that, Andrew. I think Leslie was bringing up Orkut there, which created an issue in Brazil over both standards as well as data retention and data access. So the Google caused got into a problem there in Brazil. Why don't you talk a little bit about it? Do you expect that you're going to see more incidents like that and more challenges from a other country standpoint going forward?
So that's a super interesting question to me, actually, because it's my day job. And so so what's unclear to me at the moment, well, let me step back just a step and say, right, so what we're encountering every day, because Google, like a lot of other application layer internet companies in the US, is basically a platform for other people's content. So it makes web pages searchable. And then we've got all these products that are basically places where you can stick stuff. So it's YouTube for videos, Google Groups if you've got a group of people talking to each other, Gmail for your email, Orkut is a social network that we run, Google Documents where you can do word processing online and store and share your documents. We host web pages. We've got Blogger, blah, blah, blah. So all of these products are basically homes for stuff that users generate. And counter these things first in a lot of cases is that we are running directly into conflicting laws that put us in a position of trying to choose between a normative commitment to freedom of expression on the one hand and a deference to the judgments of duly constituted democracies on the other hand. Let's leave out the case of the non-democratic countries, which I think where you can call into question whether any deference is owed to the judgments that those governments come up on a basis of legitimacy. But let's just focus on the hard cases that are before us now, where you've got countries that have made... footnote about the gambling case, by the way, it would be nice if our country was sufficiently consistent on the prohibition of activities that, you know, don't really hurt anybody, that it would strengthen our moral hand, by the way, in other countries to be able to say, we've got a clean record, but instead we prohibit some stuff and allow others, and other countries point to that and say, well, we do the same. So a really great example, I mean, I can give you two. A really great example from about 2 weeks ago is a video that was uploaded. And in the performance, he dresses like the Mahatma Gandhi and does a bunch of things that Gandhi would not personally have done, like a pole dance at a strip club. So hugely offensive to a significant number of Indians who revere Gandhi as, you know, the founder of modern India. So we got a demand from the Indian government to take the video down. So what should be the solution here? We've got a service called YouTube. It's on a .com domain name. Servers in the U.S. All the employees are Americans. YouTube has no operations in India. Google, by the way, does have a whole lot in question, is located in India. So this is the conundrum, right? And the question is, you know, what do you do about it? And on the one hand, you've got the value of freedom of expression, which says, you know, the Indian American can be offensive and obnoxious all he wants to be, but as long as he's not doing anything illegal, the proper response is not censorship, but rather more speech, critique, criticism, condemnation, and so forth. Or you could say India is a duly constituted democracy that has made up its mind, the Indian judgment about things they don't want inside India. And so I think there's Orkut in Brazil where racism is the issue. And there are a whole lot of cases where you find people provoking reactions from the other side and the other side rising to the occasion of being provoked. So on Orkut, where anybody can join and create a community, Pakistanis have created communities called I Hate India, communities that say rude things about deities that are revered by Indians, and vice versa, and then people in those countries. So at the moment, for example, Blogger is being blocked in Pakistan. Crudely and in some ways way overbroad. So, you know, the number of blogs at issue in Pakistan may be a few, but the entire service with millions and millions of blogs is being blocked from being viewed by Pakistanis. Same thing with Orkut in India. I think that's the wrong reaction, and one of the things that I'm sort of happy about is that at the moment we are getting a lot of support from the State Department, blocking and tackling for the work that we're trying to do and making this content available to people. Anyway, I don't want to say, you know, exactly there's the same answer in all cases,
sure.
But we've taken the path of sort of maintaining the principle of freedom of expression on Google.de in all cases, and where we have localized domain names like Google.de for Germany, Google.fr for France, we take down reactively the Nazi stuff that's on visible on Google.de, the racist stuff that's visible on Google.fr, where we're notified about it.
So, just to follow up on that, it seems like there's not a question whether you have the power to take it down. You could. The issue is whether or not there's a slippery slope where once you start to make certain judgments, where does it end and how do you do that? Do you anticipate going to the question of how you kind of look forward that in the end we're going to see some kind of global standards or, you know, some level of standards that say this is objectionable content, like Nazi images in Germany, which I realize are also illegal in Germany. But do you anticipate over time we're going to see some kind of standards that that companies like Google are going to be essentially create with fellow companies to try to govern that?
That's an interesting question. I was going to say, I foresee no scenario in which the United States would ever agree to undercut our First Amendment values and to start prohibiting things which are currently not prohibited. Mm-hmm. On the side of the businesses, we're definitely working on principles in the other direction. So we're working on principles to expand speech, especially political free speech, now. Whether we would come up with global standards for stuff to take down, I don't think so. I think the best way to handle this is on a nation-by-nation, case-by-case basis with as much support as possible. But personally, I think the project from – this is not a company view but a personal view. The personal project that I'm excited by and interested in is trying to make the case for freedom of expression in countries that, you know, drawing on, you know, 500 years of theory from John Locke to J.S. Mill and so forth, that in this globalized on this global network, forcing issues that have been lurking in the background of this democracy, whatever it may be, for a long time, namely that, you know, the best response to speech is more speech, the best, you know, wherever, to condemn, critique, and have their voices heard along with the people that they don't like, rather than choosing the censorship route.
You know, Tom, if I can just add one little bit on here, and I was actually thinking about this morning. There was some discussion about the gambling ban and some of the European views on the gambling ban and how, you know, American law seems to be a little inconsistent or at least difficult to comprehend there, and I'm sure most Americans have. And I was listening to the radio and NPR, and there was a little snippet on announcing that Dutch prosecutors had declined to prosecute Madonna for a simulated crucifixion in one of her shows last year under their blasphemy laws. Now, this doesn't really have anything to do with the Internet, but I think it explains a lot about what the real problem here is. First of all, I was shocked that the Dutch have blasphemy laws. I was even more shocked that the Dutch prosecutors actually had complaints and were considering bringing a case on that basis. And, you know, it goes to show that even in the, you know, so-called enlightened first world of, you know, democracies and such, we still have, on a country-by-country basis, very different ideas about them. You know, Leslie made a reference to privacy laws in Europe as being a good thing. That may be. It may. Maybe it may not be.
I wasn't specific. Well, I'm not sure. Those privacy laws. Mm-hmm. But
right. And I want to be clear. I'm not talking about the substance of any of these laws or not. But, you know, those clearly impinge upon speech of other people. So, you know, what's the higher value here, privacy or speech? And all of these things come down to a lot of different balances that are highly complex and difficult to deal with. And different countries are dealing with them in a different way. But it occurs to me that fundamentally sort of the joy of the Internet is that at the end of the day, the technology is sort of, you know, an unstoppable force. And there's only so much you can do to stop people from doing what they want to do. And, you know, if you block this and you do that, well, we'll go somewhere else. If you can't put it there, someone will start a new site somewhere else and put it somewhere. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of futility in all of these laws that's out there. And I think that is something that's going to take a long time for policymakers to recognize. But eventually, I think, you know, they will increasingly come to those conclusions and recognize that a lot of what they're trying to do in this space becomes counterproductive, and that they'd be better off getting the responsible companies that are operating in these spaces to operate responsibly of their own volition.
I know that both Alan and David want to jump in on this, and we're going to ask Steve a question that's an offshoot of this. But after that, we're going to go to the audience. So if you have a question, in about a minute, stand up, and then we'll call on you.
Yeah, and I wish it were the case that we are on an unchangeable path towards freedom. I think we are on a path towards freedom, and I think technology is leading us that way. But it is, in my experience, not at all a linear exercise, and it certainly has no clear happy ending that will happen regardless of what is done. So it seems to me there are at least three things. One is it is up to people like the State Department and others to make the tough case to those countries like China and others that are seeking to use restrictions on the free flow of information to repress their people. And the Chinese minister is sick of seeing me, I think, and he knows my talking points almost as well as I do now. But it's our, I think, legal, moral, and political obligation to make that case. But I think the tough case is not necessarily the case we need to focus most of our attention on. I think Andrew hit the nail on the head when he said, as I see it, that much of the opportunity here is to have a conversation with emerging democracies and others in explaining, not lecturing, but walking them through our analysis for why the free flow of information is good for them and for their people, and why it's good for them economically, why it's good for them socially, and ultimately why it's good and important for them politically. So the State Department has a new, relatively new program in which it is a joint effort with our sister agencies, the Department of Commerce, USTR, many others, the Peace Corps, and the like, together with a partnership with business. And we're looking forward to having a partnership with other countries called the Digital Freedom Initiative, in which we will work collectively to identify those countries, to do capacity building, working to explain why we think that the free flow of information is in everyone's interest, and particularly in those emerging democracies' interest, largely in order to try to stem the problem before it becomes a problem. Because if you can get them thinking along the ways that we think are best, and I think that they, when they reflect on it, will think it's the wise course, you don't have many of the problems that takes up so much time and creates so many problems for companies and for others, but rather we can work together as partners. And so we've been reaching out. We've had conversations with the UK, for example, the European Union, and others to find, India is another example, in which we are looking to work together, because these are common values that we think are across many governments, and it's not a U.S. position, it's not a European position, it's really one we think that many enlightened governments will have going forward.
I just wanted to pick up on the Madonna example, because I think it's very instructive often to ask how you deal with a particular issue if you weren't looking at it as an internet issue. So, for instance, crime, abuse, a lot of these things, a lot of crime isn't internet crime, it's crime that happens to be making use of the mm-hmm. internet. And once you separate those two things, it starts to become a lot clearer. Inconsistency, what's generally described as freedom with irresponsibility. And in an age of convergence, with the media, the internet, telephonic communication, all of these things, all becoming included in the internet geography, I think we have to look at them much more broadly as than just being internet issues. I think on this issue of whether you approach things nation by nation, there is a challenge for any company that's operating to both have some respect. Particularly, I think you were right to say where there's... But surely one of the approaches that we all need to support, and I think this is close to something that you were saying, David, is trying to work towards internationally agreed voluntary standards. In other words, not something imposed, but a better understanding of the reason that positions are taken, that standards are being set. Because that's where you can bring together freedom and responsibility.
Got it. Steve, bringing you into the mix. Andrew, were you trying to respond to that?
I've got a note that's relevant to this. Okay.
And then we're going to talk about something slightly.
So let me jump to the recently, which is, I do think that there's something that the U.S. government, and this is also true for the U.K., to the extent that you pursue bilateral free trade agreements these days, but we do have a very, the government has a very powerful potential tool at its disposal to deal with the kinds of censorship that and content restrictions that are plaguing businesses like mine, and that is its trade negotiating power. Countries want to enter into free trade agreements with the United States, and if you step back from contributor to the American economy these days, and by that I mean internet companies like Yahoo, Google, Microsoft, eBay, Amazon, and others, news organizations, newspapers, magazines, book publishers, movies, music studios, and so forth, these are all companies that are interested in essentially transmitting digitized information in some form or other to people around the world. For these companies, censorship and content restrictions are the single biggest trade barrier we face. And so if you think about this industry as the new Detroit, it would be nice if our government said our trade agenda is going to fight tooth and nail for the interests of this industry and to try to lower barriers to trade in information services. People seem to agree with it. And the problem, of course, is how to translate that into practical terms, because after all, in simplest form, information is power, and when you try to remove barriers to flows of information, you are inevitably challenging structures of power that have been built on restrictions or monopolies or control over flows of information. So it's not like it's going to be easy, but I do think it's a step that the U.S. government could take that's practical and real. We've got bilateral free trade agreements under negotiation right now, and I don't think this needs to be some kind of radical First Amendment sort of export kind of thing. It just simply says that government's objectives. And with that kind of basic notion out there, I think we could see over 10, 20 years may contribute to a gradual shift in attitudes towards information services.
Steve, just going back to this issue of to the extent that we're what government's role is. So last year there was a controversy over a domain name, a proposal to add a new domain name that was going to be exclusive for adult content. It was called .xxx. And it ignited a bit of a controversy, particularly in the social conservative community in the United States. Ultimately, Mike Gallagher over at NTIA got about 30,000 emails that from folks saying, bad idea. Ironically, there was some in that camp who actually believed it was a good idea, because if you could exclude it and make that kind of a red light district, you could kind of isolate it. And then there's others who believed by approving it, which the approval came down to ICANN, which is in charge of the technical elements of the Internet, that if you approved it, it was kind of a de facto endorsement of adult content. And ultimately, ICANN, with some certainly with a bit of swirl around it, both the United States government wasn't the only one involved in that, but certainly the UK government and other governments, ICANN decided to reject that proposal. It's now subsequently come back with a new proposal, so we're going to probably go through that again. But I pose the question to Steve, what role should government have when it comes to real estate, and that's really what a domain name ends up being, real estate on the web?
And I think to answer that question, you have to understand the confusion that sort of swirls around with respect to XXX, too. Because if 30,000 Americans felt motivated enough to write the State Department or Commerce Department,
you would say Commerce.
Commerce. How many did you get, David?
Oh, I'm none. And should get none going forward.
I just would love to talk to one of those individuals who wrote and really ask what they were thinking. What was their real motivation? Because it may have been founded in some sense that if you build a XXX domain, that it would suddenly increase the quantity or the nastiness of the adult entertainment out on the Internet, when in fact there's no reason to believe that at all. It would certainly XXX domain would make adult content easier to find, but by the same token, if it's easier to find, well, it's also easier to filter. And it might well be that a XXX domain accompanied with rules that forced content there would end up being exactly what those 30,000 people were really all about, was being able to instantly and easily filter adult content for making its way into their homes. But that's a multi-step process. It's a sequence of events that would have involved far more than just ICANN. All ICANN can do is to approve the sponsor of the XXX domain and their plan for admitting people into the domain and policing it. But there's nothing ICANN can do to force adult entertainment content to put its content in that domain. That would be up to individual nations, and it might well be that this nation might attempt it, or perhaps the UK. But that doesn't mean that all adult content everywhere on the planet would go there. So it's a two-step process that highlights this confusion, and the confusion is prevalent right now, and it's between governance and technical management of the Internet. Because, David, you said right away at the beginning that the Internet Governance Forum in Athens, you were pretty satisfied with how it went, but you sounded more like you were relieved. You were just relieved that it didn't turn out to be the tempest in Tunisia that had predated it. I can see that.
I'm easily satisfied.
But it's instructive for all of us. And you said, David, you set the tone for a very optimistic discussion thus far. Everyone seems to feel like we can make this work. We can find ideas. We can show the futility of censorship. But I think it's constructive to point out there are some real collisions that still occur out there that do present challenges to the U.S. government and U.S. businesses doing business abroad and UK businesses doing business here. One of the collisions is the definition of governance versus technical management. The U.S. sort of created ICANN to be the manager of the domain name system so we could all type in names instead of numbers to send email and surf the web. It's a U.S. creation. It's private sector managed, and it sort of handles everything it does through contracts with registries and registrars. Very limited missions. It's the Dirty Harry rule. Man's got to know his limitations, and they do at ICANN. Governments, on the other hand, they govern through not these contracts, but they make laws for consumer protection, for spam, trademark protection, privacy, and censorship. So, well, this isn't a collision here. This is a side-by-side. ICANN and governments are actually side-by-side, parallel lanes going in the same direction. They're both trying to maintain the integrity and the availability of the Internet. But unfortunately, every once in a while, a couple of times, the U.S. government swerved over into the ICANN lane and sort of bumped around over there and created sort of the perception that ICANN can and is more than just a technical manager. The example that pops to mind was at the beginning of the occupation of Iraq, the U.S. government got ICANN to switch who manages the Iraq domain names, to switch that registry. And that would seem to be a relatively minor issue, but it was a big deal and a rallying cry for why the ICANN can no longer be allowed to run the Internet. And David, if you remember at Athens, that was the rallying cry in one of the workshops to say that the U.S. should not be allowed to have any role or oversight over ICANN because we switched the Iraq domain. So I'll tell you, the second collision, I'll just wrap up with this.
Okay, wrap it up.
Is a genuine cultural difference. It isn't just confusion about the definition. There's a real difference. In Anglo-American world, we tend to see that if something is working really well and it's critical, we leave it alone. But I think in much of the rest of the world, if something's that critical, the government, well, of course the government has to run it. The government has to manage it. That's a cultural difference we're going to encounter at every time. And America and many Western cultures, we're trying to definitely collide with China. We're going to collide with China over this issue of censorship. Iran and Cuba to a lesser extent, but with China. I don't think, though, it's constructive to punish companies that try to engage and do business in those areas. At the same time, we're trying to convince them and show them the light. Punishing companies that engage is going to be counterproductive, since it's that engagement, I think, that has the best opportunity to produce change.
You're threatening my reputation to say I'm going to run this with an iron fist there, Steve.
Well,
Alan said he had one sentence, and I'm desperate to hear what it is.
Well, I really think that contribution was wrong-headed. I'm sorry. For instance, you just referred to the futility of censorship. If we have some censorship which prevents some of the actuality of child abuse that's behind the images, then I'm sorry, that ain't futile. There is a responsibility, it seems to me, to show that you've thought it through and that there are benefits to come from a particular approach. You can't just demand it. And I'm saying that as somebody who wants to reduce the amount of legislation that government undertakes and do things by agreement, not by legislation. But there's a responsibility to show, not to demand, that you be allowed to do what you want to do.
I'm glad we're in conflict. Liz.
I mean, I think the United States government, I mean, if you talk about, you know, sort of clashes, it spends a lot of time clashing with itself on this issue of sort of international freedom. I mean, if you look at what the proposals that come up in Congress and the conversations we're having about what's going on in China, I mean, I used to, you know, last year when we had all the concerns about the companies in China and demands that they should not be retaining information, that they should not have their servers in China. You had another part of Congress that was debating long-term data retention laws in this country, point of presence for law enforcement. And when I speak to people in these countries, what they always say to me is, your country doesn't understand when it takes those actions how much it empowers the censors. Yesterday at the State Department, I'd like to erase the last 5 years, and then I think we would have both the moral authority, but just, you know, the practical ability to deliver that message. But, you know, when we, you know, if we enact a data retention law this year, a mindless one — we don't have to enact a mindless one, but we might — then we might as well just give up on this principles process that we're engaged in, where we'll be encouraging companies not to put their data in countries that, you know, they can't protect their citizens. So we're running in two directions in our lawmaking, which is not unusual, but I think the clash is sort of particularly obvious in this area.
We're going to come back to this, because I think there's a natural tension. What I would sum up is, one man's censorship is another man's law enforcement, and we're going to get to that in a second. But we made a commitment to go to the audience, and we've taken longer than we wanted. So if there's a question in the audience, please stand up and be prepared to ask it. Sir, talk very loud.
First, let me start off maybe with the latter part, which is I hope we do not take the position. Certainly, in all the delegations that I lead at the State Department, we do not take the position that we speak for anybody, any other country other than our own. And I think that's an extraordinarily important. We work very closely with other countries. We create coalitions. We reach out. We listen very carefully. But we certainly don't speak on behalf of anybody else. In terms of the process, although I am the coordinator for all international communications policy, thank goodness I'm not responsible for all the things that are going on. That's shared across the government, obviously. Our Department of Commerce is extraordinarily active. You talked about PTO, for example, extraordinarily active. In fact, if you look at almost every part of the executive part of the government, certainly, you see great activity, and that's something that just illustrates the importance and the fundamental importance of what it is we're talking about, whether it's the Internet or communications policy generally. Having said that, I would say that as difficult as the international meetings sometimes are, and there have been some references to some extraordinarily challenging international meetings that I've had the honor of being a part of, they are nowhere near as challenging as our domestic process in order to come up with the positions that we take internationally. We have a very open process. That is, at the State Department, we have not one but two advisory committees open to the public. Before we take our positions, we listen carefully. We accept written comments. We take oral comments. We reach out actively, both here in Washington and elsewhere, taking advantage of technology. And there's very vigorous debate on how it is. In the case of, for example, the WIPO Treaty, which is handled by another part of our department together with PTO and others, I think it is fair to say that perhaps many people did not know what was going on, and I'm not going to throw stones one way or another. There's enough of that going on. But clearly, I think there was a failure to communicate up until relatively recently, the past year or so, and that process started a long time ago. But I am pleased and encouraged, and I hope you are as well, is that as that process started to come together, there was much greater outreach. We at the State Department played some role in this. Others did as well. And I think now, for a variety of reasons, that potential failure to have earlier, better communication within frankly, within the government as well as with the public and private sectors, I think has gone a long ways for being solved. I'm not trying to be an apologist. There is no perfect information flows. And, of course, even if there were, very reasonable people would disagree with where policy decisions are made, ultimately. But having said that, I think as I look around the world, the openness and the inclusiveness of that policy is not replicated, I think, anywhere else. And I say that in part because I'm very pleased to know that many countries come to me, ask us how we do that, because they would like to do more of that. Again, not perfect, but I think we're at least a little ahead of the curve there.
Great. Is there another question from the audience? Feel free.
Phil Corwin, I'm here today on behalf of the Internet Commerce Association, which is a trade group of people actually treat domain names on real estate, as you referred to. In regard to ICANN, it's unusual to have a perspective of internet governance that talks about ICANN so little. While they have committed themselves to greater transparency, after their board rejected the .XXX proposal last May by a 9-5 vote, the community had really no knowledge that they were negotiating, and then the new contract was put out for comment the next day, so there was really no transparency. Second, on the contract, so we support the ICANN model of private sector domain name system governance, but we see in this contract ICANN really getting in conflict with national governments, and when you look at the actual contract in areas that really have problems with law enforcement, consumer protection agencies, and all the very difficult issues about what's permissible and not permissible for speech, and we'll be opposing the, so I guess the confusion already for folks who own domain names and host content at those names about what laws apply and what enforcement regimes, that it would be best if ICANN would stick to its narrow mission of ensuring the stability and security of domain names associated with registry agreements.
David? It's moments like this I wish the Department of Commerce were here. Yeah. Where's John Neuer when I need him? But to address it, this has actually been a very long-running, very serious set of issues. We have tried to address that in the recent joint project agreement that was signed between the Department of Commerce and ICANN. I will share with you that we have taken, I think, as strong as humanly possible, the position with ICANN that it is imperative that they have an open and transparent process on all of these issues, whether it's .XXX, whether it's about the future of particular domain names, whether or not it should be retired or retained, those issues. We believe that that should be done in a very public process. We think that the tradition, for whatever reason, of having a series of private conversations and, as you refer to, perhaps negotiations and the like, does not serve ICANN well, does not serve countries well, does not serve the internet community writ large well, and we are actively promoting both in every way we can to try to ensure that there's greater transparency and a limitation in terms of mission creep in that organization.
I think we're talking about ICANN too little.
I just want to say, you know, it might help the debate if everybody would stop thinking about domain names as real estate.
Sure.
They're not real estate.
They're labels.
It's not like real estate. There are unique identifiers. They don't map to sites. They don't map to servers. They don't map to anything other than a number at a given moment. So, I don't know. It's totally the wrong analogy to use, and it becomes, you will relax a lot more and have a lot better kind of like karma about the internet if you stop thinking about it that way.
Well, actually, it's more like a label. It's an area code on a phone number. It's a label on a box. And I wanted to clarify for Phil with respect to XXX. I was on the calls last week with the business constituency and the IP constituency. We're talking about the application. And I think there was some confusion when they rejected it. Apparently the board rejected the contract, not the concept of a XXX. So what they've reconsidered is a new contract. And that's how it's been explained in a transparent way that the thing is back on. And from the standpoint of a limited ICANN role, all we are asking is two things of the applicant. They need to make sure they broadly represent the adult content industry like they say they are. I'm talking about the folks that want to run the domain. And the second thing is they've got to protect the trademarks and brands of everyone else who doesn't want to see a squatter jump in and buy www.google.xxx. So we need to protect those rights as well.
Right. So, David, did you want to jump in?
You're good now.
So, what?
There's like such a good reason to oppose XXX right there.
The Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee conducted some polling commissioned by Zogby International that asked a series of questions about attitudes about the Internet and usage, one of which was, will the Internet change China or will China change the Internet? Now, obviously, it doesn't have to be so black and white, but that was the question. And really what it went to is, will ultimately the forces of the Internet, because of the information sharing, force the Chinese to open up more, or would the Chinese, because of its power, both from a population and its role in the world, ultimately impose restrictions in the way the Internet's used? It's this issue of kind of the threat of balkanization. So not surprisingly, the poll came out 43 to 30 in favor of, in other words, within almost a statistical number, of believing the Internet would change China, that China wouldn't change the Internet. Two interesting notes to the poll, though. Among 18 to 24-year-olds were the most hopeful. Two out of three believed the Internet would change China. And among the most skeptical was the Asian population, who just didn't buy it. They believed China would change the Internet. Mm. So I don't know if those are come from familiarity or naivete, but ultimately there was that belief. And so what I want to talk a little bit about is, will the Internet change China or will China change the Internet? One of the issues that's arisen in the last year, last 2 years, was about intellectual property and patents and everything else. And Cisco dealt with an issue with Huawei, which went to patents and the question of whether or not their technology was essentially being lifted. It came out on Cisco's side, but I want to pose a question to Jeff about whether or not we should expect to see more kind of replays of that within the emerging markets, and China remains an emerging market, and how are companies going to navigate through that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the issue of intellectual property protection around the world, particularly in the emerging market segment, is two steps forward, one step back. Two steps forward, one step back. There are clearly going to be intellectual property challenges all around the world. Frankly, there are intellectual property challenges in the United States. Let alone going beyond that to China. But I think to go directly to the point on China, I think that as the Chinese economy develops, as the talents that exist within the country are used more and more to create intellectual property of their own, that is something that has value economically, it will increase the awareness and the need to have strong intellectual property enforcement in the country. And so I think that the forces of development naturally lead towards, stronger intellectual property laws, but also stronger respect for those laws and a greater view that enforcing those laws has value to it because of the ability to incent people to go and create copyrighted works or to go and invent things and patent them. And so, it's going to be a bumpy road, not just in China, but throughout the world. There will be people who will steal intellectual property, and that's why we have laws against it and hopefully processes for people to enforce their rights all around the world. But I do think that you can see, particularly, over time, that there's a growing recognition in emerging markets, particularly where they have strong technology-based industries there, that, they're going to need to respect intellectual property if those industries are going to work well for themselves as well. And so I'm optimistic on it, but, you have to think about this the way that we're told the Chinese think about everything, which is, decades rather than months.
Great. Alan, you had a...
Yes, I think your statistic reinforced my general view of opinion polls, which is they give you a result that's entertaining and which you can use or abuse in all sorts of different ways. I mean, how can you get an answer to a question, is China going to change the Internet or is the Internet going to change with polarization? The obvious answer is yes. Because actually all of these discussions are essentially about people, it seems to me. Is the 1 billion online, 5 billion not online? Mm-hmm. And until those figures are reversed, there is going to be a suspicion, and there's going to be a challenge, and there's going to be a lack of freeing people up in the world as a whole, as well as actually within our own nations. This is true as far as the United States and as far as the UK is concerned. So, you know, let's make the opportunity of the internet one of including people, of extending democracy, and hopefully working, and it goes back to the point right at the beginning, working towards building rather than dividing ourselves by picking rows and fights where we don't need them.
Leslie, did you want to jump in? Were you there?
I think one of the interesting things, being involved in this dialogue that's been going on between companies and the human rights community, is that notwithstanding sort of a lot of fiery rhetoric that's happened over the last year, when you pose the question, should these companies leave China? The answer is consistently no. So I think that there is a view, been made that the presence of U.S. or British or companies that bring a certain set of approach and values and mission is a positive thing. And I think it's very hard, we focus on, being forced to take down X blog, and then the number of blogs that exist in China is extraordinary. So I think I come down on the side of the internet over China. But having said that, there are things going on, like the Chinese sort of deciding to sort of start their own standards movement, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The export of that, not just the sort of export of their sort of censorship regime, but if we start developing another entire standards basis for these technologies, and that starts to, which is not as open, not as protective of privacy, we could change the internet. And China, so I think China could export things that could change the internet that would be, if we're just looking at their policies and not literally what they're building, I think we might be missing the point.
But is your fear that they opt out? I mean, that's always been the kind of the splintering,
yes,
of it?
Yeah, I think you could. I have a lot of faith in this technology.
Sure.
So I'm not going to say that I have a fear of it, but yes, we could wind up with a balkanized
so how,
internet.
If you're China, though, and you're able to leverage $1 trillion of infrastructure that you didn't necessarily have to build, and are able to create a network that essentially meets their purposes, maybe they're either winning that race in the long term or losing that race in the long term, what's the rationale for opting out of that?
I think it's control, Tom. I mean,
it's all about
as a
control.
Practical matter, it's not that difficult for them to throw up their own domain name server tomorrow morning and to tightly meter the places where they interconnect with the real public internet.
Mm-hmm.
And one doesn't think it would go on for long, but if we pressure China...
Long in our years?
Yes, Chinese years. It could be awfully long in our years. But there are opportunities for them to balkanize and split the net, and they could create any number of excuses for wanting to do so. But I think what Leslie brings up is a longer-term problem, that if they were to balkanize and splinter the web, they would interconnect, therefore have full benefit of all the content on the internet, but be able to promulgate their own standards and equipment and advantage their own providers, and it's possible, too, that they would export that to a lot of the friendly regimes they have in Africa today.
I think Andrew wanted to go, and then we'll hear from David.
Yeah, I got to say, So I think that's already happened, right? I mean, the number of points of ingress and egress to the internet in China is, less than 20, I mean, if you consolidate. So, this is also true, like mobile phone networks, for example, have gateways to the internet. It's, we live in a world of interconnected networks, and within each network you can view it as a balkanized piece. I think splitting or splintering is the wrong analogy, because it's just, not every network that comprises a part of the internet is multi-homed in 73 directions, right? Mm-hmm. It's just not the case. And so it would be wrong to declare victory simply because interconnection is continual around China, that somehow we're sort of coming out, on top. I actually think that, what Leslie is alluding to is, is a pretty dangerous threat, actually, to the Internet. I think that we spend entirely too little time and attention on standards, and I think that the enormous ability, an almost unparalleled ability, to decree a standard and have it adopted by so many consumers that manufacturers will rush to fill the need and then have this stuff be sold out. And the WAPI debate was one example of this, but it's only the first. There will be others. And I think the Chinese are acutely aware of this sort of potential.
Leverage that they have.
I will say that the, you know, sort of the flip side of this, though, just to, I mean, to make a kind of like empirical point, which is you should, you know, take with a very large grain of I'm an old China hand, but my impression of what's going on in China is that we are only barely aware and be kind of beginning to grapple with the profound shifts that are going on in Chinese society right now, fueled by the availability of mobile phones, text messaging, MMS messaging, blogs, cars, groups, anyway, all of the, you know, sort of video sites, audio, all of these things are, they are having a profound impact. I think one, you know, a great example is that, so China has always been a place where rumors travel about. What happens now, however, is when something goes on, a great example was the Chinese military killed about 50 villagers about a year ago in a southern village in China. They were protesting, I forget what, you know, they hadn't been paid in 6 months or their land was being seized arbitrarily or something like that. But it's a kind of clash that happens not infrequently in China these days. And I've heard about this. But now, villagers were MMSing, snapping pictures, sending them to their friends, sending around text messages. A video interview of one of the villagers was recorded, uploaded to the net, immediately mirrored by human rights groups all over the world, including search engines and, like Google, and is now available for anybody to listen to, a firsthand account of what happened. You saw pictures, you saw words and stories immediately. And that is very powerful. And I think the government is incredible authority, its power, its primacy within the country, and they are struggling with how to get ahead of this wave. But the wave is happening, and they are not so clueless as to think that they can just stop that wave. They're trying to figure out how to get ahead of it. And I think standards is one of the ways that they try to get out ahead of it. So I think we should all be kind of optimistic, but there is no reason to relax and just think the technology is going to, by force of its own kind of inherent internal logic, going to make this happen.
Before we jump to David, Jeff, on the issue of standards, obviously Cisco gets heavily involved in standards, and I'm putting you on the spot here when it comes to issues with the Chinese, but do you think that's a key part in terms of driving the kind of Chinese world debate?
Absolutely. I think, you know, part of it is what Andrew was talking about, control issues. Part of it is also economic advantage. You know, it's old-fashioned protectionism and, you know, trying to create a domestic industry in an area where there is not much of a domestic income. I do think that, you know, it's a two-edged sword for them, you know, from an economic point of view. Because, you know, they can create their own little island with their own set of standards, but if the rest of the world doesn't adopt those standards, it you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of economic sense for them, particularly for a country that's such a big exporter. But, you know, there are different calculations and considerations that are going on in the Chinese government on this, and I think it's something that as an industry and as companies and certainly as countries as well, we have to be wary of, because if we allow situation where largely standards are set on the basis of technical merit and the, you know, economic viability of various and sundry things we're going to market, where we create the ability to, you know, create world markets for things, that has been hugely beneficial to the entire world. And, you know, as a policy matter, we need to make sure that that continues going forward, because otherwise, you know, even in areas where we see this, you know, in silly things like digital broadcasting standards, where we have different ones around the world, or in mobile phone standards, you see, you know, difference in costs and difference in availability. And there are two sides to all of those fights, but my point is that in an open standards world, you can start balkanizing standards. Then you're not going to get the, you're not going to get the choice and the advantages of the markets that come into this, and it's something that we're clearly going to have to watch what the Chinese government does on it, and convince them that this is not good for them, and it's certainly not good for the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think it's, look, standards are a big, big, it's a big deal economically, and having open standards, open in the sense of not having government mandated protectionist type standards, is a big deal about opening markets. It's a very big deal in terms of innovation and the ability to bring new and better products to market. And ultimately, it's also a really, really big deal when it comes to freedom. The primary fight about internet governance over the past few years was about freedom. And there were those who sought to have a greater governmental role, and by intergovernmental, by multilateral intergovernmental organizations. And the necessary impact if that had happened would be that governments, and since we're talking about China, China would be obviously a very important player in that, governments would have an ability to retard the development of new, better technologies. And in so doing, lock us into where we are, but also importantly then hold hostage the ability to make changes in order to meet political needs, such as restricting the free flow of information. And so ultimately, the fight about something about internet governance was really a fight about political, economic, and social freedom. And so that's part of the reason why we fought so very, very hard. It's why we found strong allies in the UK and certain other governments as we came down the home stretch. Because there was a recognition that although at first blush it sounded like a good bumper sticker about having the world join together in trying to have a say on these types of things, but by doing so you cede to non-democratic governments an ability to veto, as a practical matter, the things that make the promise of open information, the promise of greater freedoms, the promise of better social and economic tomorrows, much, much more difficult. And so standards are a big deal. Whether it's WAPI, whether or not it's TDS, CDMA, it doesn't matter. They all boil down to the same thing, which is they are usually excuses for government control, for innovation, and better economic opportunities.
Great. I'm going to open up any other questions from the audience. Please, Garland.
Yes, I'd like to point this to David. Inform us a little bit more about coming meeting with having so that people might want to come and join.
I was trying to stay away from advertisements here, Garland. The meeting, but because we're into openness and transparency, the meeting that Garland is referring to is on February 20th. There is a meeting at the State Department to discuss the Digital Freedom Initiative. And as I mentioned before, this is the initiative of much of the U.S. government together with private industry and NGOs and others to focus on where the opportunities are in the world to have conferences, to bring our message of openness and the like. We're looking forward, as I mentioned, to working with other governments in this process. But it will be a significant meeting, and those who are interested, there's a website, as you can well imagine, associated with it. You just have to Google Digital Freedom Initiative, and you'll find the right spot.
All right. Any other questions from the audience that don't involve advertisements? Please. Well, I'd really like actually Cisco and Google to start off with that because you're two companies who are engaged in competition and would love to see what you're seeing on that. No, please don't jump first.
Well, I and then let him clean it up. Specifically with respect to, the creation of competition laws in China and other countries, I think that, it's something that has to be watched very closely because there is the opportunity to use these laws to disadvantage foreign companies. And, how they are drawn up and how they are used and enforced and whether there's transparent
it's a two-sided coin. I think we want all countries to come up to the legal standards that exist in much of the developed world as they develop, and so part of that includes competition law. But at the same time, they have to operate in a fashion that is consistent with the developed world as well, and so it's how that goes forward. But I think to wander out of China for a minute. Because while China is a very important developing country, there is an enormous part of the globe that is developing that is not China. And there are a lot of issues with respect to how business is done, in particular in spaces where either the government is the procurer or whether there is a government-owned or influenced entity on that front, and particularly in Africa. But certainly in a lot of places in the world, there's a lot of corruption out there. There's a lot of application of laws to one party and not another party. Frequently, we find that there are issues that world-based competitors who don't operate under the same strictures that U.S.-based companies operate under. And improving the rule of law in commerce all around the world, I think, is an important piece of this puzzle, above and beyond the questions of freedom. As if American companies are going to be able to thrive internationally, we have to have clear and consistent legal systems that allow us to compete on level playing fields.
Great. I'm going to give Alan the final word for the not only the question but the panel.
Well, I wanted to say that, hey, guys, you have local laws in the United States of America. And perceived from outside the USA, they look pretty restrictive against competition from outside. We think the European companies ought to be able to come in and take over American companies with the same gay abandon that American companies are able to come into European countries. Actually, Britain is the most open in this, and we'd like our European competitors to be a bit more open as well, so we take a very strong view on these things. I think the point I'd want to make is that it's very easy to look at it just from an internal perspective. And I was struck earlier on where one of the panelists, when we're talking about competition in relation to the supply of broadband, said, and I actually found some of the discussion earlier today quite shocking and old-fashioned, that it'd be fine if you had competition between four or five suppliers to provide broadband in the US, and a lot of the problems that you're trying to address wouldn't then exist. Well, we do have that. And even France, which, as I said earlier, is a bit backward, has that sort of competitive environment. Why haven't you in the United States, and why are we apparently going to have an impact on our economies by organizations like Google adjusting to the situation in America by starting to charge in particular ways, which is going to have a very negative impact in the UK? What I'm saying is that some of the things, when you look across at China or Europe, may look strange through American eyes, and you may think that we've got things to put right in our competitive environment, and you may well be right, but it looks the same the other way around. And I think that that comes back when we focus on internet issues again to two things. One, separate those things that are really about the internet rather than those things that are about competition or trade or a whole range of other issues, or censorship or communication or what the hell else. And secondly, this business that for the rest of the world to respond positively and to have trust in things like the ICANN's agent, and where you have been engaged, it's been very positive. In that debate in a free-flowing international environment, because that's the way to avoid the bureaucrats taking over.
Well, that's why it was so valuable to have you on the panel, to make sure we didn't get too U.S.-centric here. I want to thank the panelists, so how about a round of applause for the panelists? I want to thank the audience, and I'd be remiss, Tim Lorden would kill me if I didn't remind everyone that there's a tech fair on Capitol Hill that's going to start shortly. I believe it's in the Hart Building, but check when you walk out. I want to thank the audience for their questions and their attention, and have a great day.